The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Welcome to Deep Dive with the Institute for Justice. I'm Melanie Hildreth. In Virginia, you can become a state-certified substance abuse counselor. At the same time, you're barred by the state from getting a job counseling people. I'm here with IJ attorneys Andrew Ward and Mike Greenberg to talk about Virginia's barrier crime law, what it means for people who want to help others overcome addiction, and how one counselor is trying to restore some sanity to the system. Mike, why don't you start by talking about Rudy Carey? Who is he and how did he get caught up in Virginia's barrier crime law?
Sure. Rudy Carey is 51 years old. He lives with his wife in Fredericksburg, Virginia. He works as a truck driver during the week, and on the weekends he volunteers as a pastor at his church. But truck driving is not what Rudy sees as his calling. His passion and what he wants to do is to work as a substance abuse counselor. And Rudy is uniquely qualified to help people do that, to work their way through struggles with drug or alcohol addiction, because Rudy himself for years battled drug addiction. He's got his life well on track now. He's been in active recovery for 15 years. But as a younger man, his life was much more of a struggle. When Rudy was 18, his father, who raised him as a single father, was in a really bad car accident. And Rudy had the difficult, gut-wrenching decision to have to pull his father off of life support. And not knowing where to turn or who to talk to from that really traumatic experience, Rudy chose drugs and developed a really debilitating drug dependency. And that all came to a fulcrum in 2004. Rudy was driving to go and purchase more drugs, as drug addicts often feel the need to do, when he got pulled over at a traffic stop. And he tried to run away. And in doing so, when the officer went to handcuff him, Rudy inadvertently struck the officer who was trying to do that. And when all was said and done, Rudy was arrested and convicted of assaulting a police officer. That was bottom for him. He served about three more years in prison at that point. And when he got out, he knew that he really needed to change his life around. With help from his probation officer, he got into an inpatient rehab facility and completely got sober. He's been in active recovery for about 15 years now. And, you know, finally having, you know, gotten his feet underneath him and turned his own life around, Rudy decided that he wanted to help other people do exactly that.
And so for a while he did help people, right? Because I opened this up by saying, you know, that some instances, if you have a background like Rudy's, you can't get into work. But he did get a job. How did that come about? How did he get the job in the first place?
Yeah, he became a leader at his local 12-step program, and he decided he wanted to make a career out of that. And so he went to school and took over 200 hours of coursework and training in substance abuse rehabilitation. And he secured a job at a local substance abuse treatment facility in Fredericksburg. 5 years into that job, the Virginia Department of Behavioral Health and Rehabilitative Services sent Rudy's employer a letter saying Rudy is actually banned from working as a substance abuse counselor for life. Unbeknownst to Rudy, and by sheer luck, unbeknownst to his employer at the time, Virginia bans people from working as substance abuse counselors and in a wide array of other similar occupations if they've ever been convicted of one of 176 different crimes.
That is just a total flat ban. It doesn't take into account any of Rudy's record since that conviction in 2004. It doesn't take into account how he changed his life. You know, he was seeing 60 patients at a time. He won a Counselor of the Year award. He didn't, you know, deceive anyone about his criminal record. His employer knew about that record and wanted to give him that opportunity because they thought he would be that much better equipped to do it because of his own struggles. You know, we've talked to people who saw him working, and they'll tell you Rudy Carey saved lives. But none of that matters because this law just says he is flat banned forever.
Let's talk about the law. The system in Virginia involves licensure, certifications, background checks. Can you talk about how all of these different requirements and hurdles that a prospective substance abuse counselor has to clear, how do they all fit together in Rudy's case, for instance?
Well, the thing about it is it's actually a prohibition on working. What the law says is that no facility overseen by the department can hire someone who has any one of these 176 convictions. What's really crazy about it is that there are separate requirements for certification. Separately, you can get certified as a certified substance abuse counselor, and there are different requirements for that that look at criminal history, but people get certified. We know at least one person who was actually Rudy's boss, who also had a criminal history. She is certified as a substance abuse counselor by the state of Virginia. They looked at her criminal record and thought, no, this person is qualified, but she's still banned for life because the barrier says that no one can hire her, even though the state itself says she's qualified. Rudy doesn't have that certification because he knows it's pointless. He could have gotten it, he could have pursued it, but he just decided not to because he knows, you know, he's banned forever.
Well, 176 crimes, is it? That's a lot. What are some of the examples here? Because it's easy to imagine that there are some things that may be so bad that you don't want a person interacting with really a very vulnerable population, maybe. But it's hard to think of 176 such crimes. So what are some of the things that could disqualify people from direct care positions?
It's a huge range of crimes. Some of them are sort of more traditional things that you'd think of, robbery, in Rudy's case, assault. But there are also things that you really, really don't seem to bear any connection to counseling or, in fact, sort of anything. Recklessly driving a boat is one of these crimes. Different forms of hazing are on the list. If you shine a laser pointer at a law enforcement officer, that's on the list.
So you can never work in one of these jobs if you've shined a laser pointer.
If you are convicted of that offense, yeah, you're banned for life. Now, not all of them are a flat ban. That's only about 150 of them. For others, there's sort of a confusing network of some of them expire after 10 years. Some of them expire after 10 years if you have one but not two. Some of them you can go through a screening process, but by and large, It's mostly just this ban forever, where whatever you've done just doesn't matter how you've operated since the conviction, and that's what's going on with Rudy, and it affects a huge number of people. The department itself, their records say about 1,100 people just in the past 3 years have been disqualified from working because of the law.
So when we talked about that interaction between the law and the certification, it seems like, you know, I mentioned in my earlier question the sort of to give the lawmakers the benefit of the doubt that maybe there are some things where it's like, okay, this is just like a combination that we just never want to see. Why not just build that into the certification process? And it sounds like in some cases it is, like that they actually, in that process, look at the crime and kind of think through whether or not this is something that should be disqualifying for a particular person. Why on top of that have this, how did that come to be, to put this law on top of that process?
Well, it looks like it's just sort of an artifact of tough on crime policies, you know, decades ago. It seems like it started off as a regulation for sort of particularly sensitive, you know, people live there type locations. So maybe prisons, although that's not the law there now, but prisons, you know, psychiatric facilities. But as these things sometimes do, it just sort of mushroomed and it covered much broader circumstances than it might be justified. And that's what we see with a lot of these laws. You know, you just sort of have something on the books from years and years ago. There's not widespread interest in changing it because the only people that know about it are a sort of a particularly poorly treated group that's people with criminal records who are just trying to get back on their feet. And, you know, that's not a group that's organized, that's got a lobby working for it. And so you just have these old laws and they remain just sort of sludge on the books forever that doesn't matter very much, except to the people who are trying to put their lives back together, who are trying to be able to support themselves, you know, and take that first step on the ladder back to being a productive member of society.
So, Mike, we talked about the fact that Rudy can't work as a counselor, but is he still, can he volunteer? Can he still interact with these people, you know, to get to that kind of, how does this make sense within the system that has been set up? Is it a rational ban in any way? How does that work for Rudy? Could he do volunteer work?
Well, you're exactly right. That's one of the major irrationalities of this law, is that what, you know, Rudy, you know, can volunteer to, you know, offer his services to counsel people for free. And it's just a ban on a treatment facility actually hiring him and paying him as a career. He still is very engaged with his 12-step programs, and he can and regularly does you know, offer advice and just talk to people in his community when he has the time to do so, who are going through hard times. But he can't have it as he just can't be hired in a structured setting by a treatment facility that is organized to take people in. And that just makes no sense. If you're qualified to offer your services because you have really great experience in overcoming these same struggles, you're qualified, period.
So what if he had not been, when the employer was notified and they learned the extent of the law and the ban, what if they had not let Rudy go? Are there consequences? Because it seems like this is a law it hurts the person who wants to work, but are there also consequences for the employer if they were like, this just seems irrational and unjust, I'm not going to abide by it?
Of course, they could, you know, they can have problems with licensure. There are criminal penalties for violating these laws, and employers are angry about this just as much as prospective employees. You know, we've talked to employers that say this is not the way to go. We want a staff that includes people who have had these kinds of experiences, because they're the ones who can best relate to people who need that kind of guidance, that there is a shortage of counselors because they can't hire the people they want to hire because the department just won't let them do it. And it's just not something that – it's not just that he can volunteer, he can give advice, but that's all we're talking about. You know, we're talking about people sitting in a room and talking. It's not something that presents – some kind of unique opportunity for crime or something. We're not talking about an accountant who was, you know, just convicted of embezzlement and, you know, oh, now he's going to cook the books. It's people talking to each other. In fact, if he were just a different kind of counselor at a non-licensed facility, you know, if he were sitting in a room and talking to someone about how to make that person's marriage better, that's fine. He could work in that position. But if he's talking about how to work through addiction, nope. It's totally, we can't have that. He can never do it for the rest of his life.
The employers that we have talked to who specifically say we want to hire people like this, it's because people like Rudy have that experience. And if you're someone who's entering that first step of the ladder of recovery, it can feel like a very judgmental experience, and it is very, very helpful to have someone who speaks your language and has been there before to help you through that first step of the process, maybe even someone who looks like you. And employers say, like, they want to hire people like that, and this law says, nope, you can't do that.
We've talked a lot about the specific profession that Rudy is in, the substance abuse profession. But are there other? I mean, that's one of a few direct care positions that are affected by this law. Are there other kinds of occupations or jobs where similar barriers or restrictions are in place in Virginia for people who have a criminal background?
Yeah, the way it works is that there's this long list of the barrier offenses, and then different state agencies all use them slightly differently. But it's not just the Department of Behavioral Health and Developmental Services. It's also the Department of Health for being in programs to take care of people in their homes. There's a whole sort of wide network. You know, the way our challenge is working, it's limited to substance abuse counselors, but lots of other people are affected by this law.
What about in other states? Virginia is, where does Virginia rank relative to how other states approach this? Or it's obviously, we know from our work at IJ, not limited to Virginia. It's something that is widespread, unfortunately, across the country. What is the, for those who aren't familiar, what is the landscape like for people who are trying to get back on their feet?
So this specific law as to substance abuse counselors seems, if not uniquely, at least atypically harsh. Neighboring states don't seem to have a requirement like this. The federal government doesn't. And even in Virginia generally, there's usually a relationship criterion. You can't just ban someone for any kind of criminal conviction. It needs to relate to the occupation. But as is often the case, departments involving health or behavioral health are often excluded from those kinds of laws. So even though Virginia generally recognizes that it doesn't make sense to do this, you want a tight nexus, like a pharmacist who's been convicted of drug dealing or something that really, like, yes, this specific connection exists. It just doesn't for this department. For here, you have this sort of wide-ranging flat ban. But broadly speaking, across the country, there are zillions of laws like this. I mean, there are
the technical term zillion.
zillion. So the actual answer is tens of thousands, and I can't even be more precise than that because there are so many of them that no one even knows how many there are. Let alone how many criminal offenses there are. You know, tangent there. There are laws that might ban someone for any felony, but nobody even knows how many felonies there are on the books. You know, the number of federal crimes is somewhere between like 3,000 and 300,000. Nobody knows. But broadly speaking, these laws are everywhere. There has been progress on that. About 37 states have made their laws at least somewhat better since 2015. But just across the country, there are jobs for which you can be denied for any felony. Sometimes it doesn't even have to be a conviction. Sometimes it can be an arrest. Sometimes it's a really nebulous standard, something like good moral character. If you're a good person, you can work, but not if you're not a good person. And these laws are just really widespread, and it's a huge problem for people, not just who are, you know, in Rudy's case, you know, trying to help other people, but for people who just want to provide for themselves, who, you know, who don't want to be on food stamps, like one of our clients in another one of these cases, who are just trying to be able to, like, make something of their own lives after they've made mistakes. But these laws are ubiquitous, and it's a huge problem across the entire country.
I do want to talk about this case and some of the other cases and the legal claims. But before we do that, you had mentioned earlier that a lot of these laws are remnants of various tough on crime pushes, you know, in various places or at certain times. Even if you give the sort of the benefit of the doubt that you know, that's what we want to do, do you know what the impact of these kinds of burdensome laws are on recidivism? Like, is it actually better for within that tough on crime crowd? Are they doing something that's actually effective? I mean, because you can talk about the injustice of it and the irrationality of it. But does it even work like they hope that it will work?
Well, no.
short answer.
Yeah, which sort of, you know, maybe you think about it for 5 seconds, let's be tough. But if you think about it for 10 or 20, no, these sorts of things don't work. Having a job is one of the best predictors of success, you know, after incarceration. And there's also research showing that recidivism seems to be correlated with tougher occupational licensing for some of these entry-level professions. So if anything, it seems like these laws are counterproductive, that by taking away opportunities for people who are trying to get back on their feet and leaving them to struggle, you're really creating a situation where you're unfortunately, incentivizing more crime.
Okay, moving. We're lawyers. We got to talk about the law and the lawsuit. In Rudy's case, what are we challenging? You got to start taking all of these on one at a time, a few states at a time. What are we doing in Virginia?
So we're doing two challenges, as we often do in our fresh start cases. We are challenging the law on substantive due process grounds. You have a right guaranteed by the Constitution to be able to enter into the sort of field, the occupation, the work that you want. And restrictions on that are supposed to be rational. That's a pretty low standard as constitutional law currently exists. That's one of the things IJ is trying to change. But it's at least got to be rational. And we're basically making the argument that judging people for who they were, you know, in Rudy's case, 17 years ago, on this super overbroad list of crimes, that's just not rational. And the other sort of similar ground is equal protection. That has the same rationality standard, but the law is supposed to treat similar people similarly. And here we're saying that, you know, you're treating people with criminal records, with these barrier crime records, differently. It's a form of discrimination without at least that kind of rational reason. And, you know, the courts are pretty open to this kind of claim that it is hard to win cases under that rationality standard. But there are more than a dozen cases actually holding these sorts of, you know, sweeping lifetime bans unconstitutional. And we'd like a court to agree with us here.
And this isn't the first case where we have made these sorts of arguments. Can we talk about a few of the other places where IJ has filed suit? And what is, since those are a little bit further along, what is happening in the law as a result of those cases? So I think the first one we did was Pennsylvania a few years ago. What happened there? And what claims did we bring in that case? What was the result of the litigation there?
Our first fresh start case, you're right, was in Pennsylvania. It was a challenge to Pennsylvania's good moral character requirement for aestheticians and other kinds of cosmetologists. Basically, even though cosmetology is taught in prison, if you wanted to go and be a cosmetologist, as our clients did, specifically they wanted to be aestheticians, so professionals who focus on skincare, you know, doing eyebrow waxing, facials, things like that. They had to prove that they were good people. And because of their old, you know, not at all related criminal records, the state of Pennsylvania really put them through the ringer. One of our clients had to go into a hearing to try to prove to the government that she is a good person. They were asking her, you know, oh, you say you go to church now, but how do we know you go to church? Or how do we know you're complying with your parole when your parole officer's not here as a witness? You haven't really proved our satisfaction. It's like, you know, writing someone into the book of life. It's not something that
seems like such a power trip, you know.
Yeah, you know, it's not. And there was this one particular administrative judge who seemed to be responsible for a lot of the denials. But Pennsylvania was doing this. It was affecting dozens of people every year, and we challenged that requirement as irrational as we're doing this with this one. And we won. We sort of won on a secondary argument, but ultimately a court said, if this requirement is going to exist, you can't just choose some people in a salon. You know, if there's some problem in salons that needs to be addressed with a law like this, you can't exclude the cashiers who are maybe going to be the ones handling purses if there's some hypothetical theft problem. You know, if there's some problem with assaults, which there isn't. But if there were, you know, you got barbers holding razors right up against people's throats and you want to pick on the people who hold tweezers, that's just not rational. And so a court ultimately agreed with us, struck down the law on its face as unconstitutional. And in fact, one of our clients just got her esthetician's license a few weeks ago.
And as is often the case with IJ litigation, that victory proved so well known in the media that it spurned the Pennsylvania legislature to pass a bill to repeal lots of other good moral character requirements across other occupations as well.
Yeah, literally all of them. In fact, there is no longer a good moral character test anywhere. for any licensed occupation in Pennsylvania. And Mike's right, that was in part due to IGA's suit. You saw proponents of that bill, you know, talking about our clients saying, you know, this is why this has got to change. And it did.
The one of the questions that I had was the case that we won, did it apply really only to people in that one profession? And then, as Mike noted, the legislation then extended that? Or, you know, how did that work? When you bring a case like this on behalf of somebody in a particular profession, how do you make sure that it becomes as broadly applicable as possible when you're putting the case together?
Well, that's part of public interest litigation design and something that we think very carefully about, you know, who our clients are, how broad we want our claims to be. In Pennsylvania, we made sure to challenge that law, not about our clients specifically, not to say that, you know, this is wrong for this person, but that it's wrong for everyone. So while the court victory was limited to that one occupation, it wasn't limited to just our clients. It was everyone whoever wanted to do that occupation. And then the legislation was even broader, affecting every licensed occupation.
Going to the other side of the country, let's talk about California. Sometimes they take a different path. What's going on with the case that we filed there?
Yeah, so that case is about California's, I don't even know the right adjective, but I'll stick with bizarre practice of using inmates to fight fires. There is, as everybody knows, a huge wildfire problem in California, and they use prisoners who happen to cost $1 an hour instead of what a professional firefighter costs, and they use those people to fight fires. And then when they get out, they say that they can't become firefighters because of their criminal histories, which is possibly one of the craziest things I've heard about in any IJ case anywhere. The way it works is that to become a professional, like municipal or county firefighter, you have to get certified as an EMT, an emergency medical technician. But California regulations say that if you have one felony conviction, you are banned for 10 years. And if you have two felony convictions, you are banned for life. So we're representing some people there who committed crimes either very, very long ago in 2002 and in 2004 in one case, or when they were very young. In the case of our other client, his crimes were when he was 14 and 15. But both of them are banned for the rest of their lives, even though they fought fires while they were incarcerated, even though, you know, they've done all the training. They would make excellent firefighters, but they're banned for life for the same sort of irrational reasons. You just have this sort of sweeping ban that's not justified by anything. Now, that case, you're right, did take a different turn. We lost on a motion to dismiss at the outset. The judge basically said, you know, these guys seem pretty sympathetic. They seem to have a point, but it's not the place of the courts to judge the wisdom or the fairness of any sort of legislation. We only have to say whether it could possibly ever make some kind of sense. And I guess if you squint, so you guys lose. So that case is on appeal. We are appealing to the Ninth Circuit, the federal appeals court that oversees California. We just finished briefing, in fact, and it's looking like we'll be having an oral argument in 2022. And hopefully we can get the appeals court to send it back, say the lawsuit can keep going. Because we're right.
It's funny, when you're at IJ, you get kind of used to these sorts of justifications from the court. But just hearing it as a normal person, it seems like just such an outrageous thing for a judge to say. Because isn't the whole point of being of having a court to look at the law? Like, it's like what is your job then?
it speaks to like the broader. This is deep dive, right? So to get a little deep, in the 1930s, there was a case called Caroline Products that is responsible for sort of the division of some rights we take very seriously. You know, the courts can check the legislatures if they do certain suspicious things, if they treat people differently based on race, if they treat people differently based on sex. The courts will say, absolutely, I am 100% capable of judging that this is illegitimate. This smells fishy, and I, as a decision maker, absolutely have the institutional competence to be able to say that this is wrong and this does not meet constitutional standards. But if you judge people differently based on criminal history, a court will say, whoa, 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 how could I possibly decide? I am a court. I am not a legislature. This is not the institution. We don't have the expertise. We can't decide what should and shouldn't fly. We're just staying out of it. I wash my hands of all of this. That's how it works because these sorts of claims are litigated under that rationality test. But even then, people win these kinds of claims. We won it in Pennsylvania. Other people have won them in about like 15 cases. And, you know, that's what we're going to do in Virginia and California.
So you mentioned the court victories, the changes in the law, even since 2015 in dozens of states. It seems like there's a little bit of momentum going in the right direction. What is, for both of you, as proponents of reform in this area, what are the kinds of things that you're doing that other, you know, allies that we work with in other organizations are doing that can help ensure that things keep moving in that right direction?
You just got to keep up the drumbeat. You know, it's all the tools of public interest litigation, which is why IJ has, you know, strategic research. It has activism. It has legislation, and you know, we go and we support those bills. We bring the lawsuits. We justify supporting the bills by saying that if you don't do it, we're going to sue you and get it struck down in court. But it's really trying to, you know, be everywhere and cover everything. The Virginia itself is considering reforming the barrier crimes law. They have a subcommittee formed to consider how to do that. And, you know, if they know on the back end that somebody's going to haul them into court if they don't do it right,
it's a nice incentive. You know,
it's a nice incentive. And you know, the guy, the state senator chairing that committee, he was asked for comment on the lawsuit, and his comment was, "I hope they win." So you
like to do my job for me a little bit, but you know, take what we can get.
Yeah, but you know, you go everywhere, right? You do all the things. It's in court, it's in legislatures, and you just keep showing the human faces that these kinds of unfair laws are hurting people.
One in three Americans have a criminal record. You know, these are laws that, you know, they may not be particularly well known, but they're affecting and have affected a lot of people. And by continuing that drumbeat and reforming these laws and getting them struck down in courts, it's going to have a major impact on lots and lots of people who are newly able to work and get themselves on that first step of the economic ladder.
Yeah, that's a really important point. I think it's easy to think of this as sort of a niche kind of issue, you know, that matters to people who have just sort of a background like Rudy's, but that's a lot of people. So you have your work, you have your marching orders, you have your work cut out for you. I'm glad that we had a chance to talk today about what you're working on. Thank you for joining me. Thank you to everyone for listening. If you enjoyed the conversation, you can find more wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube. Don't forget to rate us and to subscribe.